The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Well, I want to thank everybody for coming, and I feel it's a great honor to be here today interviewing Dr. Sachs. I'd like to first start by asking you about your extraordinary family. You were born in 1933 in London to a family that was quite accomplished. A family of scientists, but also very cultured people, very accomplished people. Your parents were both physicians, your father a general practitioner and your mother a surgeon, one of the first female surgeons in England. I wonder if you tell us a little bit about what it was like growing up in that sort of family, and perhaps even some of the pressures that you might have felt as a boy growing up among these sorts of people.
I was as conscious of extended family as of immediate family, because my mother was the 16th of 18 children. And I had a whole periodic table of uncles and of first cousins. There were almost 100 of them, of us. And so the cousinhood was very important and remains important for me now, although now it's second cousins and cousins removed and so forth. The nine uncles, were all in the physical sciences, one way and another. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, my own first love was for chemistry and the physical sciences.
Well, may I ask you about that? Because in Uncle Tungsten, of course, you write about your early love of chemistry. And it's a fabulous book. It's part autobiography and part history of chemistry. And you describe in it that early love. Tell us about what it was about chemistry. And I know you still carry around a little periodic chart in your wallet as a talisman. Tell us about what it is about chemistry that drew you.
I had rather a bad time between the ages of 6 and 10, because when the war broke out, I was evacuated, as 3 million other children were. But I saw very little of my parents at that time, and I think in retrospect, I would say that the headmaster of the school was psychotic. And when I finally got out, in this chaotic and cruel and capricious situation, I longed for order, predictability, and sanity, and science seemed to promise that.
Interesting. Well, you do say in Uncle Tungsten, you talk about your mother having you dissect a human fetus at 11 years old, and then at 14, you dissected under her direction the body of a 14-year-old girl. And you do say this was a rather disturbing sort of experience. And yet, tell us about the rationale behind it.
One of my brothers felt I shouldn't have put this in the book, but it's too late. It's there, and people seize on it. Well, beside being a surgeon, my mother was an anatomist, comparative anatomist, and loved anatomy, and loved structure and mechanism generally. She adored the clocks. She looked after the plumbing, and she wanted me to follow in her footsteps. And I think it was just enthusiasm which made her do these things, perhaps with some slight lack of empathy for what a little boy might feel. But it didn't seem that abnormal at the time. I mean, Flaubert used to watch his father dissect bodies when he was 8. Incidentally, my mother didn't supervise the dissection. She had a fellow professor do so.
Okay.
I've had very mixed feelings about anatomy ever since.
Well, you say that your mother did want you to be a surgeon. I suppose she wanted you to follow in her footsteps. And do you think this had any part in your taking another turn?
Well, certainly when she saw how clumsy I was. And there may be evidence of this tonight. I will knock over the jug or drop something. You know, she realized I couldn't be a surgeon. Actually, both my parents had trained in neurology, though neither of them stayed in it. But it seemed my two older brothers were medical students at this point, and this seemed to be my destination, although I fought against it. Mm. So I want to be a chemist, and then later I want to be a marine biologist. Mm. Then later I want to be a neurophysiologist. And I got to clinical medicine and living people relatively late.
Interesting. Well, it is interesting that you had this lure of chemistry very early. But there was also, and you didn't mention it in your series that you just mentioned, a love of writing that you describe after you came to America, after you'd finished medical school at Oxford. You spent a year traveling across the country, sort of Kerouac style, writing, and you even had the poet Tom Gunn read your work and comment on it. So there must have been a pull in that direction as well. And I wonder if they were at odds at first and how you feel having been able to reconcile science and writing.
Well, I certainly felt what seemed to be antithetical pulls when I was younger. I wanted to write. Wanted is too mild. It was imperative to write. I mean, people who write have no choice.
Yes.
You don't choose to write. The muse or your neurophysiology or whatever forces you to. But I didn't know what I would write about. And unlike you, who write novels, I was no good at inventing characters and plots. My writing and largely my reading, even then, was much more in the way of biography and memoir and history. But I think it was probably case history which brought together medicine and narrative, science and narrative. And I don't feel torn in half now.
You found that reconciliation in case history.
Yes, I do other sorts of writing. I'm fond of travel writing. Mm. I'm fond of botanical writing.
And history writing, too.
Yes.
But I want to talk about, well, let's start with one of your early books, Awakenings, which certainly was, I suppose, the book that catapulted you to attention. And this is about your time spent in a New York hospital dealing with patients who extreme cases of Parkinson's disease, suffering from what's called sleeping sickness. And this was the time when the drug L-DOPA was introduced as a miracle drug, and you saw the effects, and you also saw the setbacks and side effects. And you wrote Awakenings about that. And I suppose most of the people here know some of those case studies. But I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the reaction to that book, which came in many different forms, and how that affected you both as a physician and as a writer.
At that time, books would come out for me in England a year or so before they came out here. Mm. I partly wanted that because I was unsure of the propriety of having written so much about my patients, and I partly thought, well, my patients are in New York. If the book is published over there, they won't know about it. Mm. This didn't work because one of my patients sort of picked up the sense of something funny going on and got a copy of the English edition, and that was outed then. But I um, The book had a very mixed reception because it became one of the books of the year so far as general readers.
Yeah.
And literary people went, but it was totally ignored, if not boycotted, by the medical profession, and for a long time was read only, was usually wrapped in brown covers and read by students. But gradually there's sort of been an easing.
So was that difficult for you to feel that the medical establishment was looking upon this book in a certain way, even though it was very successful in a popular sense?
It was difficult for me then, and it's still difficult for me because I want to please my colleagues, my fellow scientists, as well as draw everybody in, or at least draw anybody who might be interested.
Which is a very difficult task.
Yes.
Well, I want to talk about some of the case studies in particular. Let's start with Clive Waring, the person that you talk about, well, in several of your books, but particularly in Musicophilia. He was a musician who suffered from a brain infection that caused him to lose his short-term memory. And you describe the anguish he suffered living under this, but also the sense in which music helped him. And I wonder if you would talk a little bit about this case and I guess the existential aspect of it. What did it teach you about identity? What does it mean to have an identity? And what role did music serve here?
Yeah. I've written on at least three occasions about people who, on one basis or another, had a profound amnesia, which not only prevented them acquiring any new knowledge, but also deleted much of their memory backwards. The effect on identity was dramatically and shockingly and perhaps cruelly revealed when, with one of these patients whom I call the Lost Mariner in my Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat book, kept talking about his life and the Navy, the submarine he'd been in, and how, with the GI Bill, he now hoped to go to college. And he was talking about 1945 and 46. When I said, well, yes, but continue, he gave me an odd look, as you would give me if you had described your life to 2010, and I then said, continue. And at one point, I thrust a mirror into his hands, and instead of the 19-year-old he was talking about, he was faced by a 50-year-old. And he was very, very shocked by this. And I took the mirror away, feeling I'd been monstrous in giving it to him. Mm. Mercifully, he forgot the whole episode.
very quickly.
Within 30 seconds. And perhaps I knew also that he would forget it.
Yeah.
But identity may be, and personal development may be halted at a particular point. With Clive Waring, who was a very gifted musicologist as well as a musician, a great expert on medieval Renaissance music. Strangely, he and his wife had in fact discussed some of the cases of amnesia which I had written about. And then it happened to him, and in a far more intense form. So that although Clive can maintain a conversation, there has to be a rapid play of answer and reply. If there's a pause, he'll suddenly lose it all. He can't understand what goes on with him, or he interprets it in a different way. He feels he's been unconscious, been asleep, been in some sort of coma or dead, and has suddenly come to. He tried to keep abreast of things by keeping a journal, a minute journal, saying, 10:17, have just awoken, and describe things. Then he would make another annotation at 10:19, saying that the previous annotation was a lie. He had, in fact, now only just awoken. Mm-hmm. And there are hundreds of pages of these tragic, repetitive journals. But his musical powers and musical sensibility and have been entirely preserved. And Jonathan Miller made a very beautiful film with him in which you see him conducting the choir at King's College in Cambridge and improvising on an organ. And when he does this, you have no feeling of anything the matter. He seems totally intact. But then 30 seconds later, even 10 seconds later, he may have no memory of having done this. He also doesn't know what he can do. You may ask him about whether he knows a particular Bach prelude. He won't quite say who is Bach, but he will say that he doesn't know any of them. But if you put the music before him or sing the first couple of notes, he's off. And so this is a man who lives entirely in the present, who is really incapable of either retrospection or thinking forward.
Well, I don't know whether it's Clive Waring or Dr. P, who is the famous, also musician in The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, who could not differentiate between things and people. Yeah. But in one of those cases, I recall you wrote, in talking about the prognosis, you said something to the effect, you love music, you should make music your life.
Yeah.
And I found that a very interesting statement because it was an affirmative statement. You really couldn't do anything for these people, and yet you were finding from the constellation of factors this musical element and saying that this would be the life raft, yeah, essentially.
With Dr. P, sort of music was not just enjoyment. It enabled him to do all sorts of things. He couldn't dress himself without the aid of a dressing song. And everything had to be turned into a sort of song. But Dr. P is much more in the present book than any of the amnesiacs, because some of the people I talk about in the present book have no memory problems, but their problems are problems of recognition,
yeah,
of visual recognition.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the present book, The Mind's Eye, which does deal with various elements of recognition. And you talk in particular about this inability that you say is more common than we know of being unable to recognize faces. And you say that there's a continuum from the mild to the extreme, and that you yourself suffer from a mild case of this. Could you talk a little bit about what that means and what the coping mechanisms are for it?
Well, it meant that I was seeing as rather, at high school, that I was seen as peculiar or rude or arrogant or preoccupied, because I often didn't recognize people and appeared to cut them, even if I'd been talking with them 10 minutes earlier. I was myself at the time not entirely sure what was going on, but I knew I had to attend to other things, their movement, their posture, the way they were dressed, their voice. I also have a very acute sense of smell, and their smell, to identify them. I also had difficulty, still have difficulty with photographs, and since you mentioned Uncle Tungsten, in the hardback, Uncle Tungsten's family were outraged when the hardback came on, because there was a photograph of Uncle, there was a photograph which was supposed to be Uncle Tungsten, and they said, it's not. They said it's one of his brothers, and they look nothing like each other.
You had picked it out.
I picked it out. I will say I corrected the error in the paperback. And you can see for yourself how, which though I can't, how unlike these two figures are. I also had difficulty with finding my way. I had difficulty recognizing places and buildings, and was at risk if I went out for a cycle ride and didn't stick to a fixed route. And an absolute panic of disorientation could overtake me when I suddenly found everything unfamiliar and strange. Mm. I mean, basically, with faces, every face was novel to me. There was very little sense of familiarity, although I thought I was just rather poor at this until many years later I met my eldest brother, who had gone to Australia in 1950, and we hadn't seen each other for 30 years. And I found he had exactly the same difficulties with faces and places. Hmm. And his wife, he was a doctor in Sydney, his wife would make sure that the chart of every patient was brought into him before the patient, otherwise he might fail to recognize them. So at that point, I wondered if there was something genetic and familial, if the two of us had a syndrome. Now, neurologists talk about agnosia, which is the inability to recognize things, and an inability to recognize faces is often a circumscribed form of this. But this is always described as happening, as with Dr. P, as a result of a head injury or a disease. Mm. But after the Hat book was published, I got dozens of letters from people who said they'd had a resonance. They said they were not as bad as Dr. P, who couldn't recognize anything, they said, but they couldn't recognize often their near and dear ones. This had been lifelong, and that several people in their family had it. And it became apparent to me then that there must be a sizable number of people who had a congenital condition, unrecognized by neurologists. Now, largely through the efforts of a professor at Harvard and the use of the internet, the condition, which has sort of been a rather unknown to the public and to the medical profession, is sort of coming out. My colleague Nakayama at Harvard is in touch with 60,000 people with varying degrees of face blindness and has tested them stringently, which involves showing faces in which other helpful features have been removed. Hmm. This does, in fact, affect something like 2% of the population. Five or six million
interesting.
People.
It's interesting also that you didn't really, you weren't conscious of it as a disability until later in life, until you saw your brother and realized he had it. And I wonder about this adjustment capacity, which you also talk about in your latest book, well, in many of your books, but you give the example of Stereo Sue, a patient who, or a woman that you knew who had, she couldn't coordinate her eyes, and so she did not really see in three dimensions until later in life when she learned how to do that, and then the world became more enriched for her. But you describe other people who, a friend of yours with color blindness, for example, who feels that he functions perfectly well without color, would not want color. You talk about a mathematician in migraine who has migraines and yet would not want, doesn't want the cure because it's part of his creative makeup. I wonder if you could address this whole notion of adjusting to disability and what is involved with that.
I see you've read a lot of my books.
I
rather
have.
Carefully. I think this was born in on me in the late 1960s when I worked with migraine patients, and I was given stories such as this man's, which made me feel that one, before intervening precipitately, you really had to try and get a feeling of the whole economy of a life, which takes a lot of time. And although I think I'd probably felt that in different ways even as a medical student. One sometimes sees elderly people. I mean, I talk about elderly, but they're probably a lot younger than I am now. And you think they are slightly hypothyroid. They need some thyroid. And you give them thyroid, and this may push them into heart failure or arrhythmia. And you then start to wonder whether, in fact, their so-called hypothyroid state was normal for them and whether the body had slowed things down to allow a less than 100% heart to do its work. And so I think at every level one has to hesitate. With the painter who suddenly lost color perception, this was first felt as a... and this was a painter famous for his use of color, an abstract expressionist. He first thought of this as an absolute disaster in his profession and in his life. When he saw his wife as a sort of statue of leaden color and himself similarly, he was appalled and he lost his appetite. But then he started to find his new world enchanting and fascinating, and to return to painting. His friends took away all color tubes in case he used them by mistake. He became a black and white painter. And when, some years afterwards, there was a thought that it might be possible to give him the use of color again, he said he didn't want it. His world was now complete, it was reconstructed, and color would be intrusive. I do not feel that way myself about the loss of stereoscopy or 3D vision. I often have daydreams and night dreams of regaining it.
Regaining it. And yet, your point about the black and white painter certainly holds in terms of many people in the deaf community, and you've written about that as well.
I miss that. Many people who...
The deaf, deaf community, and the issue, some of the vexed issues in that area.
Yeah. Well if this man had been congenitally colorblind, and I've written of people like this in Island of the Colorblind, then such an attitude would be understandable, but color had never been part of their experience, as sound is never part of the experience of people who are born deaf and who become perfectly fluent in a sign language and who may be... integral members of a community and a tradition, and they're living from a different center. They feel complete.
Right.
As you intimate, this is now quite a hot issue now that cochlear implants and so forth.
Right.
But what was extraordinary with the colorblind painter was that he had enjoyed and employed color intensely for 65 years, and you would think he wanted it back.
But perhaps because he was a painter or an artist and perhaps was ready for a turn, the black and white offered him something there. I'm speculating here, but it seems to connect with his creativity.
Right. Well, certainly when his late work was exhibited, people said he had ended a wonderful late style. But that, of course, was his creative use of a disability, in a sense.
Yeah.
Oh, but that's the wrong way to put it. But for him, other aspects of the visual world are brightness and texture and contrast and became heightened.
Well, I want to switch a bit and talk a little bit about your writing and your love of writing. I know that you are a great admirer of 19th century fiction and Dickens, maybe... Eliot Hardy, D.H. Lawrence, I know, is a favorite of yours. I wonder about what you feel your own writing, if in any sense you feel you have elements or extensions of some of the great 19th century narrative. And I would include here Sigmund Freud, and if you feel any particular kinship with the Viennese psychoanalyst.
Well, first, I need to confess that I feel quite a lot of kinship for a minor 19th century writer, namely Conan Doyle, and the Sherlock Holmes stories.
Uh-huh.
I do partly think of some of my case histories as detective stories.
Uh-huh.
At one level, I love the whatever people say about Freud. He was a master of clinical narrative, and his clinical narratives are as gripping as any novel. And this was also so with a figure who was very important to me and with whom I communicated in his last years, and this was the Russian psychologist, Luria, A.R. Luria. And again, with one of Luria's books, a book about a man with an amazing memory and imagery called The Mind of an Eminist, I read the first 30 pages of this thinking it was a novel. I then realized it was a case history, with a detail, and not simply a detail, but also with a beauty and drama, which was like Freud or even more.
Hmm.
And to some extent, Luria has been my model. He dealt with neurological syndromes and their effect on a person's life, and not merely negative ones like head injuries, but a positive one like a prodigious memory, which was a sort of genius in a way, but one which in fact had the paradoxical effect of impoverishing life, because the precious gift of forgetting was denied.
Was lost. Yeah, interesting. But returning to Freud, if I might, it does seem to me that you do what Freud does, which is you insert yourself often into your case histories, into your narratives, and you also have relationships, see your patients, you visit them in their homes, you maintain friendships with them. And I wonder about that. I mean, again, Freud did that too. Do you feel a kinship there? And do you have any thoughts about the so-called, doctor-patient relationship and the separation that should exist between doctor and patient?
I think there needs to be both intimacy and separation, and perhaps the separation allows the intimacy, so that as in a confessional or whatever, people can say to the doctor things they would not say to anyone else. I don't see this as a so-called good patient. Often means an obedient or compliant and servile or passive patient. I like subversive patients who argue and who contradict and who in a sense are much, much more alive. I feel I don't have a sense of, I'm the one in charge. I have a sense of equality. We're equal but very different, because they have the experience. I may have some expertise, but my task is to try and get into their minds and experience what they do or imagine their experience. And now I think this is readily possible in psychology and psychiatry, because I think all of us can experience every human emotion, so that we can say enjoy all of Shakespeare's plays, and we can imagine what it's like to be King Lear as much as Cordelia. With neurological things, it's more difficult. You spoke of Parkinsonism before. Can one imagine what it's like to be Parkinsonian? I wondered about this when the movie of Awakenings was made, and I wondered whether De Niro, how much he could enter this alien state.
What did you think?
I think he did so uncannily well. And there was one particular point when I introduced him to patients, but I also at times try to show him, to mimic Parkinsonian problems. On one occasion, I was showing him how, with the absence of balance reflexes, Parkinsonian people might fall suddenly and incontinently backwards. And at that moment, De Niro fell suddenly and incontinently backwards on me and almost knocked me over. And at that point, I thought he's not acting. I thought he's actually got it. And I did, in fact, wonder, by a sort of mad theory, whether if one acted Parkinsonian with sufficient conviction, one might become it.
Interesting.
But I have to, one way and another, try and imagine the unimaginable, and the impact on people's lives, and have respect for this, I say, for the economy of a life.
Would you say that is what a good physician would always try to do?
Absolutely. And I think this, I think the retreat of medicine to clinics and hospitals has its downside. You can't judge how people are affected by things, I think, unless you make a house call. When my father reluctantly retired at the age of 90, partially retired, we said to him, "Pop, at least give up the house calls." And he said, "I'll give up everything else, but I'll keep the house calls." And I have the same feeling that's the truest observations. And say with the first patient in my present book, a woman who in the clinic, this was a great pianist, probably she was known to some of the audience, Lillian Kalia, and her problems first came on in a concert when there was a sudden change from one Mozart piano concerto to another one, and she glanced at the score to remind herself and found it unintelligible. She could see the notes and the staves and all the markings. Everything was perfectly clear and completely meaningless to her. And this was the beginning of her problem. But then other things became involved. You know, I've forgotten my train of thought.
Well, I think
it
had to do with your visiting. This was someone that you visited in her home.
Oh, yes, right.
And you heard her play,
when I tested her in the clinic with pictures of things, she was so bad that I couldn't imagine how she could exist in real life. And I had to make a home visit to see. Yeah. But when I did so, I found that this woman who could recognize nothing in the usual way had, in fact, arranged everything in the apartment by color, by shape, by association, by context. And so she had developed a way of dealing with this, although it made me think of how, say, an illiterate person might find a place in the book. They would have the whole appearance of the book without the meaning. And so their home visits were crucial.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you spoke about your father, and he was a general practitioner and very much a people person from what you have written. He loved dealing with people. Your mother, on the other hand, was, as you put it, loved structures. She was an anatomist, and she loved to dissect. And it seems to me you have these two components to your personality, and it finds itself in your writing as well, in the subjective and then the more historical or academic side. And I wonder if you think about yourself as moving back and forth between the person and the structure.
Yeah. Yes, I do. Goethe, by the way, used to commute between a mortuary where he was interested in dissection, especially of the origins and insertions of muscles and how the muscles worked. But then he would go from there to a theater where he saw acting and dancing above all. and the beauty of the living body. Mm. And for him, you know, anatomy and art were, you know, were of equal importance. And perhaps to some extent, one couldn't understand one without the other. I mean, although one may dissect a corpse, you don't really understand how the muscles work until you see them in action.
And how would you relate this?
Someone like Leonardo or whatever was a consummate anatomist as well as an artist.
Okay. Well, I know I just got a motion saying we want to open to questions in a moment, but I wanted to ask you one or two more things because I have a lot of questions here. I know that you were friendly with W.H. Auden, the great writer, poet, who I think was instrumental in your publishing Awakenings, and he certainly called that book a masterpiece. I wonder if you could tell us something about Auden or perhaps something that you may have learned from him as a writer, if anything.
Well, I originally saw him when he was professor of poetry at Oxford in 1955, but I never met him, and I was awed by his presence, although in fact he would go every morning to a cafe and anyone could sit down and have coffee with him, but I was shy and didn't do so. But I did meet him in New York in the later years of his life. He had a special feeling for doctors. His own father, G.A. Auden, in fact, had been a pioneer looking at the sleepy sickness, which I... and that may have been a reason. And Auden came along and saw some of our Awakenings patients. And he reviewed my first book, which was Migraine. But when it came on to discussing these other patients, he said, you have got to include poetry and philosophy, and this cannot be purely medical. You must never depart from medical truth, but you've got to put flesh on it.
And so that was an inspiration early on for the kind of writing that you...
I'd wanted to do that, and it sort of liberated me. And at the same time, I was reading Luria, who did the same, if I say he employed the devices of a novelist, this sounds too dry and conscious, but he was an artist at heart and would talk about the art of observation.
Well, you have been named, and this will be my last question, you've been named Columbia University's first artist. Just like that, artist. And I wonder, I know you were also professor of neurology and psychiatry at Columbia, but this artist position, what does that entail?
It entails my going to the other campus, the Morningside campus, and meeting people who perhaps are in the journalism school or whatever, and talking about non-fiction writing or having seminars with them on non-fiction writing and case histories or perhaps the portrayal of clinical conditions and problems in films and movies
I guess doing what you please.
Sorry?
Doing whatever you please. Right.
Yes. Yeah. Well, when I was at Cornell, I had a title I loved. It was Professor at Large. And this meant that I could sort of, employ all my interests. So I'm interested in whatever Greek mythology, paleobotany, I wish I had that title rather than my rather cumbersome multiple title now. I feel a lovely sense of completeness because it means I'm not just a medical person. Certainly, in medical school, although it may be so full of great people and discoveries, is narrow, and you feel deprived of the rest of life. And this fills it out.
And undergraduates are fun to teach. Anyway, let's open this to the audience. Are there microphones out there? Yeah, here. So if you'll raise your hands, I'll call on you, and I may repeat your question if Dr. Sachs feels he doesn't hear it too well. So there's somebody back there in the second to last row.
This is such a pleasure. Dr. Sachs, I heard you this today on the radio saying that Stereo Sue had gotten binocular vision in her 40s. Is that right?
Yeah.
I acquired it last year at the age of 72.
Mazel tov.
And I found that my eyes, I had suppressed distance vision in one and near vision in the other, but they were very happy to work together after all that time.
And has this has this added something to your life?
Well, driving home from the ophthalmologist, the trees all kept jumping out on the side of the road, but I began to see that that's how you could tell what was closer.
She could tell what was closer the trees were jumping.
And have you now sort of calibrated this jumping out, and are you comfortable in this world where of near and far and protrusion and recession?
Oh, I love it. I really do. But when I take my glasses off, I'm plunged back into that strange two different images world that I lived in before, I look desperately for my glasses.
Yeah. I love that world, too, and I was actually a passionate member of the New York Stereoscopic Society and all that. And I think stereo vision can be as beautiful and important as color perception. And I'm delighted that you have it. And I'm very sorry that I've lost it.
Well, I wish I could trade.
It used to be a medical dogma that if one had not acquired it by the age of 2 or 3, one could not acquire it. It was felt to be a very critical age. This is now being revised and other explanations. By the way, have you written to Stereo Sue?
No, I only heard of her today.
Okay, well, do so. She's a wonderful person, and she would be intrigued by your letter.
Other question? Yes. Here, in the front. Yeah.
Yes. Thank you. My mother had Alzheimer's disease, and after she had already been in a nursing home, and she was really pretty lost. Occasionally, we would take her out and found a couple of ways to communicate with her. She had been an artist, not a professional artist, but she had done art. And we took her one day to the Widmer Gallery, and we were, when in the car going, she was just non-communicative. When we got into the museum, she started looking, and she started explaining to us the underpainting, and she was totally clear. And this went on for like 45 minutes. And then we went back into the car, and she was gone again. That was really bizarre. So that made me think of how can I reach her in other ways. Mm-hmm. So I brought photographs of her family. I brought one photograph. We'd taken pictures of some of her paintings. I brought this one picture to her, and it was a woman on a blanket, kind of like a picnic, seeing her back. And I said, "Mom, you did that." She said, "No, I didn't do that." I said, "Mom, look at her behind. She had a nude behind. You painted pants on her." And my mother had this sheepish look on her face, right? And she recognized that I could get to her with the emotion, And she got that. And I would bring pictures of the family, and she wouldn't know who they were. And I pointed out her favorite brother. And as soon as she recognized him, she recognized everyone. So it was like finding a key.
Absolutely.
And the keys were music, pictures, and art. Right. It was kind of like, because those were kind of, and her family, those were the things that were emotionally the most potent to her.
Yeah. Well, you've put this so well, I could only agree with you totally.
I'd like your kind of your thoughts because I thought of your books when I was doing this, and so I was wondering, you know, how this fits into some of the things that you talked about. You know, that's kind of
Well, certainly, you know, you provide context, you provide emotion, and you know, allow the network of associations to come alive again, and it's. The essential thing, however advanced the disease is to provide a link like this or meaning. Music is very potent, but painting can do so as well. And then suddenly and completely, the whole person may be there, and then they'll be lost. But I think. This means, I work among other places at old age homes, and they need to be as rich as possible in terms of art and symbolism and everything.
Well, what amazed me is that was still there.
We'll go on to someone else.
Yeah, good.
There's someone right there.
Two questions, please. In your difficulty in recognizing faces, do you have difficulty in recognizing expressions on faces?
Recognizing
expressions?
No difficulty.
So, nor
beauty. So I may say that someone has an exquisite but sullen face, but I have no idea whose it is.
And the second question is about the woman who did not recognize things and. Was she able to use things even though she could not recognize what they were? Was their function independent of recognition?
Could she, a person who could not recognize things, could she use things even though she couldn't recognize their
Oh, yes.
Nature?
There's a separation between the mechanisms of visual recognition and action. There are separate pathways in the brain, and one may lose one without the other. One may have no idea of what this is, but nonetheless use it quite appropriately. Also, someone who is agnosic and an artist can copy a portrait or make a portrait very accurately, but they have no idea what they're doing. Is the difficulty what?
Is it a difficulty with naming what the object is? Where is the difficulty if its function is there?
I'm missing this.
I don't understand. It,
can she not name the object because she can use it, but is she not able to name it?
It's not just a difficulty naming. It's having no idea of its meaning, its function.
Okay, someone there?
I have comments to two of the people who have preceded me. First, a quick note to the fellow whose mother has Alzheimer's. I'm a music therapist, and one of our credos is to use music that were popular when your mother was in her late teens and early 20s. Those are often the ones that are most resonant to her and will bring her back, and I've seen that in my practice. Also, the woman back here with stereo vision has given me great hope because I am trying to achieve stereo vision as we speak. This is my doctor right beside me. And I am just now beginning to get a sense of the trees leaping out, and I really shouldn't drive because I've gone around with the fall foliage just with my mouth hanging open and thinking, you know, this is probably better if I'd watched the road, not the trees. But my one question for you, Dr. Sachs, I'm sorry.
Why were you trying to get stereo vision? Did you feel your vision was deficient?
Oh, I've had strabismus. I'm really like Stereo Sue, and we've been in touch. I've had multiple surgeries. I was cross-eyed, then I was wall-eyed. I've had surgeries on both eyes. But I didn't realize...
But can one miss what one has never experienced?
Right. And I didn't know what I was missing until I heard Stereo Sue on NPR. Oh. And I immediately bought her book and read it and was devastated. And thus began my mission. And only once or twice I had a sense of being in space rather than looking at space, since you've been in the very... I'm so sorry you've lost yours, but I wondered if that's what you felt.
For me now, there is no space between objects, and whereas previously there was a world of solid objects with spaces in between, which I inhabited, now I have some sense of the world as a flat canvas with colored shapes which move. Although they have the normal perspective and occlusion. And so things are somewhat like a painting, in particular like a 13th century painting.
My sense was that for that brief moment where I had this, and it's always if I'm moving or in a car, where instead of things being in front, behind, to the left, to the right, they were around me. Yeah. And then I lost it.
Yeah. So. Good. Well, you also write to Stereo Sue.
Okay. There's only time for one more question because I'm being told that we're out of time. But there's somebody right here.
I have a partial form, where it's not that strong a form of face blindness, but bad enough that if I talk to somebody one day and see them the next day, I have no idea who they are. If I haven't seen my son for a number of months and he wears a hat or a different, and hasn't moved, so I can't get his demeanor, I have no idea who he is. But what I noticed is when I was younger, I had no idea I had that. Mm. And I'm wondering, do you have it all the time, or does it get worse as you get older? And it is in my family. My mother had it. My brother had it. So I'm having a feeling it's hereditary. But do you notice with your patients, does it get worse, or you just happen to acknowledge it as you're older?
No, it doesn't get worse. And hopefully one learns to live with it more and find other ways of doing things. Although there are many different sort of lifestyles, I think in my own case it has perhaps reinforced a certain tendency to shyness or reclusiveness. But with others, it may almost make them more sociable. But they will immediately strike up a conversation with people and find out who they are.
Right. I've sort of learned to deal with it. I've also learned to tell people that I have that I meet them, I didn't do before.
I think we are going to stop because I know Dr. Sachs is going to be signing some books. Up front, are you? So let's thank him for being here today.
Thank you, thank you. And thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.